Yeah, 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Today is Monday, November 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the White House sets low expectations as U.S. President Biden and Chinese leader Xi meet virtually Monday.
The U.S. sees China as its strategic competitor, with Beijing seeking to grow its military and economic influence around the world.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken heads to Africa for talks amid intense diplomacy to avert civil war in Ethiopia.
I am very concerned about the potential for Ethiopia to implode, given what we're seeing both in Tigray.
And witnesses say at least five protesters have been killed in huge demonstrations that hit several Sudanese cities. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The White House is setting expectations low ahead of U.S. President Joe Biden's virtual summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Monday, saying the meeting will focus on managing the terms of competition between the two rivals, but is unlikely to end with a resolution of differences. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara has this report.
The virtual meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping is scheduled for Monday, a follow-up from their phone call in September. The White House is already downplaying results. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Part of the discussion was about the importance of that leader-to-leader engagement, not because we are seeking and we're not specific deliverables or outcomes, more because this is about setting the terms, in our view, of an effective competition.
The U.S. sees China as its strategic competitor, with Beijing seeking to grow its military and economic influence around the world. In the lead-up to the meeting, however, rhetoric from both sides has softened. In another positive step at the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, the U.S. and China, the world's two biggest CO2 emitters, unexpectedly announced they would work together to slash emissions and meet regularly to address the climate crisis. Patrick Cronin is the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute.
Xi Jinping and President Biden both want to find some stability from which to work, to cooperate where possible, to compete and even to confront where necessary. None of that's going to stop going forward, but I think the tone is going to be better through the Olympics.
Still, differences over human rights for the people of Hong Kong and Uyghur minorities will likely remain unresolved, as will issues of trade, freedom of navigation, and Beijing's military buildup in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait. Robert Daly is the director of the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the United States.
We can expect President Biden to say that America still abides by the One China policy, and Xi Jinping to say that America has been trampling all over that policy. So neither leader, as I said, has changed his goals. Each seems to be searching for a formula, the words, that will convince the other that all of their own actions are okay. And that is unlikely to happen.
Ahead of their meeting, the two leaders attended a Friday virtual summit hosted by New Zealand, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, where Xi warned against letting tensions in the region relapse into a Cold War.
We should be forward-looking, move ahead, and reject practices of discrimination and exclusion of others. Attempts to draw ideological lines or form small circles on geopolitical grounds are bound to fail.
Xi was referring to U.S. efforts to strengthen its partnerships in the region, including the Quad grouping with India, Japan, and Australia. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
The White House will host a tribal nations summit on Monday, the first such event in 5 years. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King reports.
The White House will host a tribal nations summit on Monday, the first such event in 5 years. The White House expects leaders from more than 570 tribes to join the two-day event. The Tribal Nations Summit will be held virtually due to the coronavirus pandemic. President Biden is set to speak Monday. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the summit coincides with National Native American Heritage Month.
The president will address tribal leaders and announce a number of steps to improve public safety and justice for Native Americans.
First Lady Jill Biden will also speak, along with Vice President Kamala Harris on Tuesday and several other members of the Biden cabinet. Among them, Secretary Deb Holland, the first Native American to lead the Interior Department and a member of the Laguna Pueblo.
We're committed to robust tribal consultation and living up to our trust and treaty responsibilities.
The summit, usually at the Interior Department, was not held during the previous Trump administration and is being hosted by the White House for the first time. Jennifer King, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is heading to Africa this week for talks in Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal. His trip comes at a time when many worry that Ethiopia's year-long war in the Tigray region may be worsening into a deeper conflict, as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Tensions in Ethiopia have risen following reports that Ethiopian authorities have rounded up hundreds of Tigrayans, including some who are United Nations and African Union staff members, days after the government declared a state of emergency. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke about the situation at the State Department.
I am very concerned about the potential for Ethiopia to implode, given what we're seeing, both in Tigray, but also as we have different forces and different ethnic groups that are increasingly at odds.
In the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, where officials have urged residents to take up arms to defend themselves, Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson Dina Mufti had this to say about the detained UN and African Union staff members.
Ethiopia's state of emergency.
There is a force that is undertaking measures to ensure the rule of law prevails in Ethiopia. A resident UN staff should respect the law of the country. They are not in space. They are in Ethiopia. They have to respect Ethiopia's law one by one. If they don't respect the law of the land, they will be legally held accountable, whether they are a UN or African Union staff.
Blinken said Friday the United States is working closely with the African Union envoy for the Horn of Africa, Olusegun Obasanjo, who is shuttling back and forth between Ethiopia and Kenya to help broker a ceasefire in the conflict that has left thousands dead and hundreds of thousands facing famine. Persuading the parties to hold talks is the only good path forward, former Ambassador Makila James tells VOA.
Dialogue is the only long-term solution because this is a war that could drag on for a long time with no winners and lots of losers.
Ethiopia is likely to be high on the agenda as Blinken makes his first in-person trip to Africa as Secretary of State next week, visiting Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal. Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled to Africa in February of 2020, including a visit to Ethiopia. Competition between the U.S. and China for business and influence in Africa was a major theme during that visit. This time, the State Department says the secretary is focusing on African solutions for African problems. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Witnesses say at least five protesters have been killed in huge demonstrations that hit several Sudanese cities on Saturday against last month's military takeover. Meanwhile, the Al Jazeera News Network reports its Sudan bureau chief has been arrested. Matthew Lara Tonda of Reuters reports.
Witnesses and medics say that several protesters have been killed in the mass demonstrations across cities in Sudan, protests against last month's military coup. Huge crowds have reportedly defied tear gas and gunfire. In the capital, witnesses say security forces moved in to disperse the protesters as soon as they began to gather on Saturday afternoon. On a hospital bed, this protester told us he knew the risk. People shouldn't stop, he's saying, and despite his injuries, he plans to rejoin the protests. He's ready to be a martyr and said his goodbyes before he left home. Back on the street, this protester says for decades, Sudan has been so backward compared to the rest of the world. Civilian democratic rule is the only way for our country to advance. The reports of fast reaction from security forces may be a sign that authorities are stepping up their efforts to squash protests and civil disobedience. Previously, they'd waited until later in the day before moving in on the crowds. And a doctors group, which is aligned with the protests, says that in one city, security forces stormed a hospital, beating the staff and arresting injured protesters there. Sudanese police say they haven't used firearms in the protests and that it began peacefully before turning violent. They say dozens of police were also injured and police stations attacked. The army chief, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, denies this is a coup and says the army intervened because of political turmoil and to safeguard the transition to democracy. Also in Sudan, the Al Jazeera TV network says its Sudan bureau chief was arrested in a night raid on his home. The news outlet says no reason was given to it for the arrest and is demanding his release.
That's Matthew Laratonda of Reuters. Nearly 200 countries signed a Glasgow climate pact at the end of the COP26 summit Saturday, pledging to speed up action on tackling climate change. However, last-minute pressure from China and India saw key pledges of phasing out fossil fuels watered down. Henry Ridgewell reports from the summit.
Hearing no objections, it is so decided.
The gavel came down on 2 weeks of intense and sometimes emotional negotiations. 197 nations finally agreed on a deal aimed at preventing catastrophic climate change. The summit president, Alok Sharma, described it as a fragile win.
History has been made here in Glasgow. And what we now need to ensure that the next chapter charts the success of the commitments that we have solemnly made together in the Glasgow Climate Pact. Thank you.
The goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, first laid out in 2015, remains a key pillar of the Glasgow Agreement. And for the first time, the Climate Pact included a reference to ending fossil fuels. But to the dismay of many delegates, last-minute pressure from India and China forced a watering down of the language. India's Environment Minister Bhupendra Yadav explained his country's objections.
How can anyone expect that developing countries can make promises about phasing out coal and fossil fuel subsidies? Developing countries have still to deal with their development agendas and poverty eradication.
So what was signed off in the final text? All countries agreed to come back next year with improved targets on cutting emissions, much sooner than the previous five-year cycle. They agreed to phase down, rather than phase out, coal and fossil fuels. Rich countries agreed to increase their commitments on climate finance, the money they will pay to poorer countries to adapt to climate change and decarbonize their economies. And there's new recognition of the need for richer nations to compensate developing countries for loss and damage from climate change. There was an agreement on international carbon markets whereby CO2 emission quotas or credits can be traded between countries. And there were separate deals on reducing deforestation and slashing methane emissions. The deal was a compromise, a text that all 197 parties signed, some reluctantly. Is it enough? Opinions differ widely. The United States Special Envoy on Climate Change, John Kerry, was upbeat.
We are, in fact, closer than we have ever been before to avoiding climate chaos and securing cleaner air, a safer water, and healthier planet.
The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres was circumspect in his assessment of the deal.
The approved texts are a compromise. They reflect the interests, the conditions, the contradictions, and the state of political will in the world today. They take important steps, but unfortunately, the collective political will was not enough to overcome some deep contradictions.
Jennifer Morgan, the executive director of Greenpeace International, said the deal didn't go far enough.
Well, I think it's meek and it's weak, but it does send a signal of the end of coal. So that is a good thing, but it doesn't meet the moment.
Outside the summit, climate activists made their feelings clear. Some were arrested as they tried to scale the summit barriers. After 2 weeks of intense negotiations, delegates are now heading home.
The next big milestone is the COP27 climate summit, scheduled to be held in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, in 2022. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News at the COP26 summit in Glasgow.
Bangladesh's climate envoy Salimur Haq called the COP26 outcome on Saturday, quote, an absolute failure, unquote. He said wealthy countries failed to make good on an unmet $100 billion climate finance commitment to support developing countries from 2020, with the text calling only for the money to be delivered, quote, urgently. During the conference, a range of wealthy governments stepped up with new pledges totaling about $960 million for two key UN-backed funds that help vulnerable nations adapt to climate change. And the amounts pledged remain far below the annual $70 billion developing countries are thought to need now, an amount that could rise to $300 billion a year by 2030, according to the United Nations.
As far as I'm concerned, it is a failure, absolute failure. There may be other good things in it. I don't care. It's a death sentence for the poorest people on the planet. And not only that, the polluters are saying, to hell with you. We don't care. We're not going to give you a penny. Not disappointed. I'm angry. As you disappointed is too low a word.
We'll bring it up again. We're not giving up, but we are describing this COP as an abject failure because it hasn't been able to rise to the occasion of dealing with loss and damage. It doesn't matter what else they do. That was our issue. The poor countries, the vulnerable countries came here for that, and they've been slapped in the face.
That's Bangladesh climate envoy Salimur Haq. With the United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP26, now over, countries are looking to begin funding a global counterattack on rising temperatures on Earth. Meanwhile, scientists in Denmark are searching for clues to our warming planet's future by studying ice from the past. VOA's Arasha Rabasadi has more.
Under dim lights, so as not to contaminate the sample, researchers cut frozen sediment in a journey through time to an ecosystem of the past. Andrew Christ is one of the researchers at the Ice Core Archive in the University of Copenhagen's Niels Bohr Institute. At this library, samples like the one he cut through earlier sit on shelves awaiting study. The frozen, muddy sediments once lay nearly 1.5 kilometers beneath the Greenland ice sheet. U.S. scientists drilled them out in the 1960s as part of an effort to establish a military base there. Experts say those deep samples are the only ones worth studying. The Niels Bohr Institute's Bo Vitner is part of the international team of scientists using a technique called luminescence dating that reveals when minerals last had direct sunlight. Along with other readings, it could show previous temperatures when the Greenland ice sheet previously melted away. Initial results from 2020 suggest that happened in the past million years. Christ says as scientists, it's their job to give the world a guiding playbook.
This is how the Earth works. If you add too much carbon to the atmosphere, it's going to get too warm. You're going to melt the ice sheets. You're going to change weather patterns, and it's going to make life very difficult for us as humans. Or we can look towards a different path with less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and a future that is not as uncertain and difficult for us.
Late end to end, the frozen samples here would stretch more than 20 kilometers. Researchers keep them constantly chilled in freezers at negative 30 degrees Celsius. According to a study published in 2020, Greenland lost a record amount of ice in 2019, yielding enough water to cover California under 1.25 meters of water. It is estimated that if all of that ice were to melt, sea levels would rise by more than 6 meters. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
In Senegal, voters go to the polls in January to elect local officials. Last week, Ousmane Sonko, one of President Macky Sall's biggest opponents, announced that he will be a candidate in the race. Observers say the move signals his intention to run for the presidency in 2024, despite the fact that he was charged with rape earlier this year. Ibrahim Akane is the head of the African Union Advocacy Program in West Africa and an advocate for the Economic Community of West African States with the Open Society Institute. He spoke to reporter Ricky Schreier about Sonko's plans for the future.
For this election, this is the first attempt after the presidential election. This is the first attempt by Sonko to really show to the Senegalese population that he's popular, that he has, clouds, and that he's capable of not taking over the power in 2024, but at least being able to shake the baobab. You know, for me, I see his attempt to compete in Ziguinchor as the first attempt to be elected.
Do you view this as more of a move toward continuing his presidential bid?
This is just, in my view, apart from what I just said, it's also an opportunity for him to show that Casamance is in his pocket. And if you have Casamance in your pocket, it's quite very useful for you when 2024 comes and you have, because 2024 will also allow, I think, Khalifa Sall coming in the election.
Do you think this could position Casamance as, in general, as somewhere that maybe would be more of the national discussion when it comes time for presidential elections then? Especially because Sonko is so much in the national eye, in the national media already.
Yes, but you know, even if you are in the national eye, in the national media, you need to have a stronghold, you know, and Sonko doesn't have any stronghold. And I think what he wants to show is that what happened during the last presidential election was not just a small event. It was a trend. Now, he wants to confirm that trend by having a stronghold in Casamance.
I think one of the biggest economic questions anyway when it comes to Senegal and development questions is the offshore oil. Are there any candidates who are running who have a really differing view on this issue as in regards to the oil?
Well, when you look at the you know, we are very far from 2024. It's 2020. We are 2021. And I think the politicians have not yet determined what will be their own strategy and how do they engage the government on a number of issues. But from what I know, for example, somebody like Khalifa Sall is not really talking about the oil issue, talking about many other points like the mismanagement of the national resources, all these issues, the economic situation of the country and other stuff, rather than talking about the oil and other, because many of them are of the view that this oil, nobody knows when it will be, we will start exploiting it. And also, when you look at the recent days and weeks, there are many, many doubts about investment, a lot of investment on fossil energy. And that's also, I think, put the Senegal strategy, Macky Sall strategy, not in doubt, but in question.
That was Ibrahima Kane, the head of Africa Union's advocacy program in West Africa. He was speaking from Dakar to reporter Ricky Schreier. In other news, a prolonged gun battle between rival gangs inside Ecuador's largest prison has killed at least 68 inmates and wounded 25, and authorities said it took most of the day to regain control. Saturday's bloody fighting is the latest violence to hit the Litoral Penitentiary, which was the scene of Ecuador's worst prison bloodbath less than 2 months ago, with 119 dead. Officials attribute the clashes at the prison in the coastal city of Guayaquil to gangs linked to international drug cartels. The governor of Guayas province says that in initial battle, inmates, quote, tried to dynamite a wall to get into Pavilion 2 to carry out a massacre, unquote. The bloodshed came less than 2 months after fighting among gangs killed 119 people at the prison, which houses more than 8,000 inmates. The prison violence comes amid a national state of emergency decreed by President Guillermo Lasso in October that empowers security forces to fight drug trafficking and other crimes. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Scientists in South Africa have announced the discovery of the first partial Homo naledi child skull in one of the world's richest hominin fossil sites. The discovery at a UNESCO World Heritage Site near Johannesburg, called, quote, Cradle of Humankind, unquote, reveals that non-human species performed rituals with their dead thousands of years before humans did. For VOA, Marisa de Klerk visited the site and has this report.
We've got you descending at 1 minute to 11. Good luck.
For Lee Berger, project leader of the Rising Star expedition from South Africa's Wits University, and his team searching for Homo naledi fossils, A normal day means contorting themselves to crawl through a maze of narrow cracks and holes 30 meters underground. It's by this effort they found the partial Homo naledi child's skull on a remote limestone shelf in the Rising Star Cave. Consisting of 28 fragments and 6 teeth, the find is being called Fossil Leti, short for the Setswana word Letimela, meaning the lost one. Leti was discovered 12 meters beyond the Dinaledi chamber, where the first fossils belonging to the previously unknown Homo naledi species were found in 2013. Berger, a paleoanthropologist, says Leti's solitary location is significant.
She wasn't dragged in there by a scavenger or carnivore. There are no marks of that on her bones. We know she wasn't washed in there. We can see that from the sediments. We know she didn't crawl in there because the rest of her body, which would be much stronger than these parts, isn't there.
Berger surmised that one of the other Homo naledi moved Leti to that inaccessible shelf. Fossilized juvenile hominin skulls, like South Africa's world-famous Taung child and Leti, are extremely rare because the remains are so fragile. Homo naledi remains in general are also much more brittle than most other fossils, which have completely turned to stone. Bernard Zipfel is the curator at Wits University of one of the world's largest hominid fossil collections.
It looks like bone that could have been deposited there just the other day, certainly not many millions of years ago. And that's what also makes this very interesting, that we're dealing with actual bone here.
Leti's discovery was made in 2017, but only recently revealed to the public. Based on its teeth, scientists determined Leti died between the ages of 4 and 6. Her remains are believed to be as old as other recovered Homo naledi fossils, says Rising Star Expedition geologist Tebogo Makubela, who is based at the University of Johannesburg.
Because of the similarity of the geology with the same sediments and the same deposition or preservation style, we believe that it is the same time period of 241,000 to 335,000 years old.
Leti will soon be included with the other Homo naledi fragments of more than 20 individuals, along with Littlefoot, the most complete hominid fossil found so far in Wits University's hominid fossil vault. Marise de Klerk, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers from Wellesley College in Massachusetts, along with colleagues from Canada and Vietnam, say they have the first documentation of how Asian honeybees sound the alarm to warn other members of their hive of an attack by giant murder hornets. This is what it sounds like. Researchers say in a press release that the honeybee alarm signals sound similar to the shrieks, screams, and panic calls made by other animal species. The scientists found that these alarms cause the bees to increase their numbers at their hive's entrance and start methods of defense, which can include spreading hornet-repelling animal dung around colony entrances. The researchers' findings were recently published in the journal Royal Society Open Science. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu up in Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
This is the voice of America, Washington,